Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. And Kathleen, where are you in the world amidst all of this coronavirus panic, and how are you holding up?
I'm in the Santa Clara County area. I'm lucky because although we were among the first places in the U.S. to have coronavirus cases, we were also the most proactive, and we have flattened the curve very effectively. So I feel pretty happy to be here. But, you know, I'm getting a little cabin fever like everyone else.
It's hard not to at a time like this. So,
yeah.
So Kathleen, this is a question that is, I certainly don't know the answer to it, and I think it's a question on a lot of people's minds, which is, can you file a patent on a strain of high THC cannabis?
Well, that's a great question, and I think there's a lot of misunderstanding in the industry. And the answer to your question is an emphatic yes. The federal legality of cannabis, including high THC strains, is completely irrelevant for purposes of patenting cannabis strains. There are many issued patents on cannabis strains, as well as pending patent applications currently before the United States Patent and Trademark Office. So I strongly encourage cannabis entrepreneurs to go ahead and file patent applications. There's a number of different options for doing that, which we can talk about. But the answer to the question is emphatically yes, you can patent high THC strains.
Well, that seems to be contrary to just what a lot of people think, right? The idea that the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office is not sitting there policing what's legal and what's not. But a lot of these patents have been filed, and we've seen them. Our law firm is actually in the process of defending with a great lawyer out of Texas named James Gourley, and Donnie Emmy, our partner, is working on a case where we're defending the case on behalf of a CBD company in Southwest Denver against UCAN. And UCAN went out and got a patent on a cannabinoid formulation that roughly reads as follows, and I'm going off the top of my head here, so bear with me.
Okay.
A liquid formulation of cannabinoids, of which 95% thereof is CBD. So it begs the question, A, did the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office even know what cannabinoids were at the time? Did they identify that this is somehow something novel or new, if in fact that's a threshold requirement? And the idea that all of a sudden you're looking at the broadest formulations possible and the patent office granting those patents. So, you know, what is your thought on that? Or at least can you take us through at least your understanding from the outside how this rush of patents over the last 2 to maybe 10 years hit that office? And are they better now than they were, or is it sort of the same old, same old?
Well, first of all, that's an incredibly important case because it's the first case in federal court in which a patent holder seeks to enforce a patent concerning cannabis-related invention. So really important. A second thing here is that let's make a distinction, which is as between cannabis plants, and in this case, a formulation, in particular, an extract from a cannabis plant. And those are different things, really, in terms of the patentability and the sorts of considerations that you have to bring to the table. There's a lot of smart people at the patent office. I believe that, it isn't that they don't have the expertise, but their problem with respect to cannabis patents generally is because it's a new, relatively speaking, area. There isn't, and things have been kind of in the shadows. Examiners are giving very broad claims because there isn't very much in the way of something that's known as prior art, which is searchable literature and patent applications and issued patents that the examiners must consider in order to determine whether the invention is new and non-obvious, which are the criteria for patentability. So in this case, a 95% formulation, you're absolutely right. It's a ridiculously broad claim. But what the examiner was up against was that he went into the database, searched existing journal articles and patents, and lo and behold, nothing came up that was disclosing 95% formulations, and so he granted this patent. And you see this in early sorts of, you know, young industries, which is that the patent claims tend to be very, very broad initially, and as the technology develops, they get more and more narrow as the art gets more and more crowded. So personally, I think that these claims are vulnerable. They're extremely broad, and I would not be surprised if they were at least some of the claims invalidated, but we'll have to wait and see what the court does.
Well, it also begs the question, right? When you say a formulation where 95% of all cannabinoids is CBD, I don't even know if there's scientific agreement or consensus on how many cannabinoids exist or if there's a definitive list. It sounds like every couple of months there's a new announcement that there's a new cannabinoid identified. There's also this idea that there's certain compounds within the plant that are attached to cannabinoids that could be deemed a cannabinoid and could not. And, you know, there's some real interesting components there from a scientific perspective as you really slice and dice that, because that's really
right.
What you have to do. But let's talk about patents for a moment and how the recent announcement of GW Pharma that the FDA and the DEA have reconsidered their drug, Epidiolex, and said it's no longer deemed a scheduled substance. Now, Epidiolex was scheduled as a Category 5, a Schedule 5 drug within the last 6 to 9 months. That didn't mean CBD was ever scheduled. It meant Epidiolex was scheduled based on what was the formulation therein, which contained CBD. And as I understood it, CBD derived from marijuana, of all things, versus a hemp-derived
right.
CBD. So tell us a little bit about your perspective on that, and what does that mean for patent protections going forward? Because it seems like if Epidiolex is no longer deemed a controlled substance, it's still a drug with a specific formulation that would seemingly still require a prescription. What does this mean for patent protection or patent enforcement going forward?
Well, first of all, I worked for GW's primary competitor, so I know a little bit about this. And Epidiolex is a proprietary extract of cannabis, and so you're right. It's not a pure drug. It's a bunch of different things. The fact that it is no longer a controlled substance simply means that it is not something that is under the purview of the Controlled Substances Act. And there's been a lot of confusion because I think people have read this and interpreted it to mean that CBD is no longer a controlled substance. And so I think that that is not a correct assumption. What it means for patentability, I'm not sure it changes anything. At the top of the segment, I pointed out that cannabis inventions are legal regardless of whether there is THC present or not. Legality is irrelevant with respect to patenting cannabis inventions, in particular plants and formulations. And so I don't think it really changes anything in this respect, but it is an important thing for purposes of GW's marketing.
Well, but let me just dissect that just for a moment, because
sure.
you speak from a position of authority on this. So
uh-huh.
I've always maintained, and I still do today, uh-huh. that CBD is not and has never been a scheduled substance. It's nowhere to be found in the Controlled Substances Act. The word
right.
cannabidiol are nowhere to be found. The only cannabinoid that's specifically identified is THC, and that okay. has been in one court case deemed to mean synthesized or synthetic THC only. So then it reverts to the definition of marijuana with an H of all things under the CSA. So if marijuana,
uh-huh.
if they're deriving their CBD from marijuana, then that CBD is indeed a controlled substance, not because it's CBD, because it's a marijuana derivative. If they derive it from hemp, then it would not be a controlled substance under the plain reading of the Controlled Substances Act. So what you're saying is that Epidiolex, the formulation, the specific formulation, is no longer a controlled substance. And just crystallize for our listeners why.
Basically, by fiat, I mean, it's the government says it isn't, and so it isn't anymore. And I don't think that there really is anything more to it than that, which sort of points out that this is really ultimately, at the end of the day, arbitrary and a policy-based decision. You know, the problem here is that whether or not something is derived from one thing or another is, to my mind, irrelevant. You need to look at what is actually in the composition. And so it's sort of mystifying to me why it matters what the extract has been derived from. But that's what we have to live with for now. And so we need to get to a point, however, where we really have some good experimental data with respect to the relative toxicity and the efficacy of the different compounds in cannabis. And you're right, it's hugely complicated, and there's a number of, you know, on the order of hundreds of different compounds that have some bioactivity, although only one which has hallucinogenic effects, which would be THC. But, you know, any one of those compounds could have important medicinal effects, and any combination of those compounds could potentially act together to create a effect that is greater than the sum of its parts. So there's a vast amount of research to be done into cannabis and into cannabis extracts. But there's a lot of opportunity there because of the fact that we don't know so many things. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that it does help people in many respects. But there are also some things that we need to keep in mind and respect. There is some evidence that CBD has some liver toxicity. I don't think that the details of that have been really worked out from the standpoint of how much of it leads to toxicity. There are some other, it is a strong metabolic inhibitor, so we need to be mindful of potential drug-drug interaction effects as well. In enough quantities, water is toxic. And so you just need to kind of get your ducks in a row, get your data, do your experiments, and determine what are the parameters of safe use, and what is the biology of these compounds. That's really important, and that's where the opportunity is for inventors.
So, Kathleen, if I am a cannabis operator, what options do I have right now to protect my IP, and how important is it for me to do so?
Let me just take a step back real quick. IP is, I think, commonly understood in the cannabis community as being synonymous with trademarks. But really, it's a generic term, and it encompasses not only trademarks and trade dress, but also copyright, patents, and trade secret protection. So your options sort of depend on what is it that you're trying to protect and what is your overarching business strategy, which is a really important place to start. It is potentially expensive and very time consuming to secure intellectual property rights. And so I think companies, their first step should be, what are our business goals? What are our markets? What are our products? And what makes the most sense in terms of what kind of intellectual property protection we seek? That said, you have a lot of options. If you are trying to protect technology, your options there are things that are useful, new, and non-obvious. Your options there are patent protection, which sort of fall into a number of categories, utility patents, plant patents, and design patents, as well as plant variety protection, and trade secret protection, which is has some advantages with respect to the duration of the protection. You also have the opportunity for trademark protection, which is really something that protects branding. It protects the goodwill that you create in consumers, as well as protecting consumers against kind of false passing off of false goods. And then you have copyright protection, which protects the more sort of expression, you know, artwork and compilations and things like that. But from a technology standpoint, we're really looking primarily at patent and trade secret protection. That said, it is possible to secure and use patent rights in combination with trademark rights in a way that at the point at which the patent expires, you still can maintain more or less indefinite exclusivity if you have sold your previously patented product under a trademark.
Well, and as we look back at where our conversation started in regards to patenting a high strain or a high THC strain of cannabis, if we kind of shift our focus over to hemp, you know, when I think of hemp, I think about the European plant breeders who have been using plant variety protection and abiding by UPOV for so long. And I'm wondering, how can U.S. hemp breeders use PVP to make up the difference? You know, we haven't been doing this here in the United States. We haven't been breeding hemp the way that they have in Europe. So what should hemp plant breeders be thinking about if they're here in the U.S. and they are making progress?
Well, the first thing is that kind of the bottom line is innovation. You have to breed and innovate and do your field work in terms of identifying varieties that have superior traits with respect to perhaps their growing characteristics in certain microclimates, perhaps their yield, their lignin content. You know, there's a number of different traits that any one of which could be advantageous from any number of standpoints. And so that's where you have to do the hard work. But with respect to making sure that you're protecting the time and money that you've invested in developing those strains, in the realm of hemp, plant variety protection certificates are very important. Plant patents are also useful, but there's some downsides to those. And in the area of hemp, you don't run into the problem that you would with cannabis varieties, where you have to you're unable to deposit the plant mandated plant material because it contains THC. You don't have that problem in hemp. So I would say innovate and then protect. And there's really no substitute for that initial hard work of innovation. We have a really strong agriculture industry here in the United States, and I have every confidence that the hemp breeders and cultivators are going to, make up the difference in short order.
Now, Kathleen, we talk a lot about different intellectual property rights, and you touched on the trademark issue. When you're talking about IP, you talk about patents. There's certainly copyright issues. There's trademark issues. There's a variety of different IP-related areas of the law and ways to avail yourself of those protections. Trademarks haven't been as clean and clear as patents have in terms of intellectual property protection. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, they do different things. And with respect to clean and clear, if you mean that there's more sort of difficulty with respect to getting registration with the United States Trademark Office, that is true, and that is because of the fact that cannabis is currently still federally illegal. But there are ways around that, ways of sort of getting initial protection and brand recognition for a mark by using it with non-plant products. You can also seek protection through state trademark registrations, which is sort of a little more cumbersome because you have to get that registration in every state in which you plan to sell your product. but, in states where cannabis is legal, you can register trademarks for use on plant material. And so you just have to have the help of a good intellectual property attorney who is familiar with the ins and outs of all the state registration requirements and can help you decide what makes sense for your business and then get the registrations accomplished.
In light of the fact that we are seeing such a drastic and dramatic push towards registering all forms of IP in the cannabis industry. And that's nothing new. We've seen that over the last several years. What are some areas that you would suggest our listeners look at, whether you're a business owner or an investor or just something to look out for? What are some hot areas? You talked a little bit about, you know, plant registration versus the, you know, the idea of patenting formulations and the like. What are some things that we should look out for?
Well, I think you have to, you know, think in terms of what is your business about. If your business is technology driven, you need to be thinking in terms of seeking patent protection, because really, you know, there is no other way to ensure that you are have control over how your invention is used. You know, Elon Musk showed us that it is very possible once you do secure patent protection. If you want to give it away and allow other people to stand on the shoulders of your own company's innovations, you have the option of doing that. But if you have patent protection, then you can control who you let do that. And you have negotiation leverage too, in terms of if you, you know, don't want to give it away, you have negotiation leverage in terms of what price you can command. And the other advantage of patents is that it is a business asset. It's, you know, it goes to the bottom line of your company and can produce revenue as well. But you need to be thinking in terms of what is your technology. And the most important thing, though, I would say with respect to patent protection is that, unlike trademark protection, in order to secure patent rights, ideally, you need to file before you ever publicly disclose or sell your products. There is a grace period in the United States that is not uniformly true globally. In fact, we are in the minority of countries that do have a grace period, and in any respect, those deadlines tend to slip. So I strongly recommend that if you have a technology company, you retain the services of a patent attorney and just talk to them about what it is that you're doing. And, you know, kind of maybe spend a little time and maybe invest a little money into determining whether you have anything that is potentially patentable. I think that the cannabis industry is really due for some crash course in patent law with respect to understanding that many inventions are patentable, but that you have to be a lot more proactive, unlike trademark registration, which relies on sales in order to create the rights. You really can't, or you don't want to disclose your inventions before you patent, because you potentially can forfeit patent rights that you might otherwise be be entitled to.
Well, Kathleen, you are such a wealth of knowledge. You have so many years of experience helping inventors and innovators craft their IP strategy. We are so grateful to have you as a guest on the Hoban Minute. We can't wait to have you on again soon and just keep digging into this important topic.
Okay, well, I appreciate the opportunity, and stay safe and stay well, everyone.
You too.
Thanks, Kathleen. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Hoban Minute special series on coronavirus and cannabis. You can head on over to hoban.law for more information on this podcast or the Hoban Law Group. If you have any ideas for subjects that we should be covering or any questions you want to pose to Bob or myself, shoot us an email at media@hoban.law. And stay tuned for the next episode on this special series, coronavirus and cannabis.